Morning, everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will come to order. It's about 10 minutes after 8. And with us this morning, so far, is Representative Dahl on my left, Representative Coghill on my right, Representative Johnson, and myself, Chair Bob Lynn. And we have three bills on the agenda today, HB 166, HB 171. 166 deals with contributions from the permanent fund, HB 171 accommodating the 90-day session, and HB 13, which will be the major bill we discuss today, is Retirement System Liability Bonds Corporation. I would like to begin with the 166, because I think hopefully we can move that out rather rapidly. We've already had discussion on it. So we're going to go to HB 166, then we have a CS for that. Would somebody make a move, please, to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the committee adopt the CS for House Bill number 166. For reference, it is 25LS0678/C-Cook.
Thank you very much. Without objection, CS is adopted. Casey, are you here? Representative Thomas couldn't make it, huh?
No. He sends his apologies.
We might send him a message.
Good morning.
For the record, Casey Schroeder Hotch, staff Representative Thomas. Would you like me to
speak up just a little louder, please?
Would you like me to explain the changes?
I'd like you to move the microphone a little closer.
We'll turn it. Leave the microphone. We'll turn it up.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
My hearing aid batteries are getting weak here.
Okay. The changes were a combined effort of everyone in the committee and the sponsor, and we thank everyone in the committee for working with us on this bill. The first change would be that on page 2 of the former bill, lines 20 through 28 was deleted, and those were the lines that set up criteria about being a youth workforce development group or something like that. And that was a problem with the committee, so we deleted those lines. So now we've opened it up to all 501c3s except for one limitation, and that limitation is on page 2, line 15, which says that basically if your parent organization is a group as defined by APOC, then you will not be eligible, and that is the only limitation that we have. The third change would be that we cleared up some language on page 2 to make it clear that every 501c3 that's eligible needs to reapply every year, and this gives oversight so that we are reassured every year that they're eligible, and we don't have to go find them if we think that they might not be. So it puts a burden on the 501c3 to reapply every year and reassure us that they're conforming with the standards in the bill. The fourth change is on page 3, line 24. And that before a contract with a corporation or organization that's going to be managing the program is executed, a copy of their policies and procedures needs to be on file with the Department of Revenue. And this just allows the department to know how they're going to be managing it and if there's an appeal process and stuff like that. And the fifth change is right after that on line 26 of the same page, page 3. And that language just allows the department to circumvent the procurement code if they want to.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. I believe we closed public testimony in the last meeting. I'm trying to remember if we did or not. We have Sammy Poyoski, Rasmussen Foundation for Questions and Answers Only. Any questions for her? If not, I'll close public testimony. And I would accept a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
I would suggest
Johnson.
The committee move CS for House Bill number 166 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, so passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can tell Representative Thomas, see how fast bills move when he sends his staff in here?
Right.
I'm not sure that was the message we wanted to send.
Okay. Let's move quickly to the next one, HB 171. I have 171, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could have Representative Seaton come forward. We are entertaining a suggestion that of a 30-day break, and it's a concept that he brought to me, and I thought it would be good to hear from him. And then, Mr. Chairman, there's a legal opinion that I wanted to just kind of bounce off the committee before we proceed with this discussion, but if I'd sure like to have him introduce it. I think it's a worthy concept to consider.
This is a very important legislation. We have to accommodate without an audience. Changes, some changes will have to be made to accommodate the 90-day session as approved by the voters in the last initiative, and there's several problems that that causes. And Representative Seaton has a concept to lay before us, and we'll just hold it for consideration after that and then move on to the other bill. So please identify yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm Representative Paul Seaton, District 35, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this issue with you on the committee. I've been struck by the debate in both the House and the Senate that the big question is how can we eliminate 25% of our time in Juneau and still accommodate the other desire of the people, and that is to not diminish the public's ability to access through either debate or through notification of the legislation as it goes forward. And so I would urge you the consideration of splitting the session into two portions with a 31-day break between. And I don't believe that there was any campaigning during the initiative process that talked about this necessarily being contiguous or continuous section. Although that is in the wording, that was not contained in the debate. And just to let you know, I have talked to both of the sponsors of that initiative that are still here, the House member and the Senate member, and they both feel very secure that they think that this idea of splitting the session into two portions with a break in the middle comports with the initiative intent. You do have a legal opinion that the Constitution allows or permits the legislature to modify an initiative to make it workable document, although those modifications can't violate the intent or the spirit of the initiative. And like I say, I've talked to the sponsors of that, and they are in agreement that this does not violate their intent or the spirit of the initiative. We could accomplish several things with a 90-day break. One is that now there's a lot of excused absences that take place, and we could eliminate that because everybody would know that if it's going to be 45 days and 45 days, and then there's going to be a 31-day break, everybody can pretty much stay around for that length of time. On these short weekend breaks, legislators spend most of the time flying instead of being either with their family or accomplishing those business parameters or business decisions that they're trying to do. And this would give them that time. Also, with a 30-day break, legislators would have enough time to meet with a good array of their constituents. Myself, I have three major communities in my district, and if I go back on a weekend, there's no way that I can get to them all. If we constructed it during the right timing, right now we have basically a break where we go to energy during the Energy Council, and we also have the Easter break that are kind of generalized, recognized. If we construct it right, the 31-day break could encompass both of those, and so when the legislature was here, it could proceed without the interruptions such as those. And also, like the Anchorage caucus, which pulls a lot of legislators out, that could occur during that 31-day break. And Mr. Chairman, I keep saying 31 because when I actually read the legislation, it actually says 90 continuous days. You know, it'll adjourn in 90 days, unlike our current situation in the Constitution that says, you know, it's 120 after the first day. So if we go to 90 days, we're actually getting rid of 31 days, not 30 days. So the other things that this will do is that we've had determined that there's a real problem for session staff, those that are hired for during the session. We have a legislation that says for retirement and for step increases, if you serve 115 days, you can get a step at a, you know, basically someone serving almost the entire 120-day session. However, if we went to a 90-day session, there's a real question of, well, are people just not going to ever get a step increase, or do you have to modify that? And there's a real dispute whether people want to go to 85 days and allow a step increase. There are a lot. If we did this proposal, then those session staff could stay employed, stay manning the front desk. We would take a recess for the 31 days, and we wouldn't have to modify those retirement things. And with staff, we're also in the problem of, are you going to be able to recruit staff to come down here for 3 months? I mean, they have to do their moving expenses. They have to come down here for a four-month period, or, you know, a few days on either side. But there's a real feeling that we're going to lose a lot of ability to recruit staff if it's only a 3 months, unless we pick up their moving expenses, which then again gets us back on to having probably the same kind of expenses that we have. I think you probably noticed on the fiscal note or the discussion of this earlier that there's hardly any savings, because the difference between session per diem and long-term per diem is very minimal. So since most legislators would be working a good portion of this time on their own anyway, and collecting long-term per diem, if they stayed on session per diem, they could maintain their housing here in Juneau, and it would not disrupt the housing market and all those kind of things. So I just wanted to bring this to your attention as a way to actually maintain the five-day public notice, maintain the same number of hearings that we have scheduled for each bill, continue with the public dialogue without having to start going into teleconference meetings and things that the public really doesn't. If members are spread around trying to participate by teleconference, I don't think that you get the same level of engagement on issues as you do when you're having your in-person meetings here. So I think that this would accomplish the goals of the initiative. And I would just like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that you do have two legal opinions. The first one is dated March 16th. This was to me. And if on the second page, that first paragraph where she says, if I am correct, the legislature is not by the statutory session limit under AS 2405-150B, then the legislature is legally free to adopt your proposed schedule as a compromise position designed to limit the actual number of days the legislature meets to the 90 days. And the second legal opinion on March 20 is a little shorter. However, down at the bottom you'll see, so long, and the question that was asked is, since the Constitution says that we can't break for over 3 days without agreement of the other body, could a statute, this statute that's going forward that had established that recess, could that be considered as the agreement of the bodies? And as you see in this last part of the second paragraph there, so long as both houses cooperatively abide by the statute and neither expresses its determination to force the other house back into session, I believe that the statute will serve as an acceptable evidence of concurrence in the recess by each of the houses under Article 2, Section 10 of the Constitution.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, very interesting concept here, and I want to congratulate you recognizing the needs of the staff here, because people forget that I made comments on the House floor about we're the tip of the iceberg. So much of the work is done by the staff, and it's going to accommodate some of their needs. And I would invite the committee to study these legal opinions carefully, and I think this deserves some deeper discussion. And before I go any further, I need to have someone make a motion to adopt the CS for, put my glasses on here.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is the E version of the House Bill 171.
Would you make that?
And, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt for the committee purposes the CS for House Bill 171, State Affairs. That is the E version dated 3/16/07 by Cook.
And I'm going to object for discussion.
We object for discussion, and then we'll hold this bill. And just very quickly, not more than 2-3 minutes, did you have a different concept you wanted to explore at the next meeting?
Mr. Chair, at some point, I hope that Representative Coghill will explain the differences between the e-version and the regular.
I think I could do that in probably 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
Please.
Then I can remove my objection.
Okay.
And then I'll do what you said.
Well, we're still going to have discussion at the next meeting, so.
Mr. Chairman, I have also a recommendation that does some stuff, too, that we can discuss at a later time, but.
Yeah, a lot of gentlemen came in, I want to get to it, so it made it very quick.
If I can do this within 2 or 3 minutes, just to explain, if you have the C version before you, I can tell you what has been taken out. That would be the easier way to do it.
All right.
So if you get the C version, on page 3, section 5 has been deleted. This deals with that each house must adopt rules. We left it that the rules must be adopted by both legislatures. So this gave the opportunity for each house to adopt different rules, and that would have gone down a pathway that I don't think we really wanted to go.
No.
So that was a suggestion I decided to put in there that I think we should take out. Section 8 on page 4 deals with the carryover bills, that if it's not passed by this house or any house within that first session, it dies. That somehow didn't gain the popularity that some thought it would.
I'll verify that.
And on page 6, section 14, the disclosure of contributions was deleting. Let's see, what was the deal with that? That whole section is taken out as part of the amendment process, which I think deals with timeline issues. So, and then section 15, once again, remember the administration said they'd rather bring the budget to us in December, and we had put January, and so we took that out, leaving it in December. And Mr. Chairman, I think that is the sum of the changes, except for the conforming changes to sections.
Very good. And we'll revisit this as soon as we possibly can. I'd like to go to.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I remove my objection.
Remove objection.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good job.
With that, we'll hold this and we'll get back to it as soon as we possibly can. And we're going to move now to HB 13, which speaks to retirement system liability, bonds, and corporations. And we invite a good friend and legislative neighbor, District 32, I'm District 31, up to introduce his bill to us. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone today. For your record keeping, I am Representative Mike Hawker, representing District 32. I sincerely appreciate the committee's taking the time this morning to hear House Bill 13. And any of you that have taken a chance to read through it, it can be an intimidating and very complex-looking bill, but respectfully, it really accomplishes a very, very simple thing. House Bill 13 provides governmental employers in Alaska with a tool, a financial tool, that potentially could save the taxpayers of the various jurisdictions of this state a great deal of money. We're talking money that could potentially have the word billion associated with it. But we're going to save the state money in paying off the unfunded liabilities of the PERS and TERS retirement systems, or assisting in paying off those liabilities. I think by now everyone in the state, and certainly those of us in the legislature, are very well aware of the mounting liability we have to our retirement systems. And I think when we start seeing the numbers coming out of this year's valuations, we keep hearing that it could be in excess of $10 billion that we're going to have to come up with sometime to fund these systems. If we think about the liability of a pension system, the unfunded liability is really very much like the mortgage on a home, a residential mortgage. The difference is instead of having, the owner of the home having to pay off a mortgage to a bank, in this case, we really, as the government, we have an obligation to pay off a liability to the pension funds. We owe this money to the pension trusts. And it's my opinion that as elected officials of this state, what we owe our constituencies is to find the best ways we can to pay off that loan, that obligation to the trust, in with the least possible expenditure of state treasury and public treasury to the other governmental employers in the state. And we do have tools available to us that can be result in significant savings. Again, just like using the mortgage example, our liability to the pension fund is an absolute constitutional liability. We have no choice but eventually to write that check. And $10 billion is really a large amount. I mean, we talk about numbers around here, but when you really think what $10 billion is, it is absolutely staggering amount of money. A huge responsibility for us, and that cannot emphasize why it's so important for us as policymakers to look into the means that can let us minimize the amount that that check has, when we write that check, minimize the amount that it's going to be. This is a home mortgage makes, I think, a very good analogy to the situation we're in, and something that I think everyone in the state can understand, anyone that's ever been involved in a home mortgage. One way to minimize, lower your home mortgage payment is to, find another bank that'll refinance you at a lower rate than your existing bank and going and refinancing the mortgage. If you're paying somewhere, 8.5% on your mortgage, and the bank down the street will give you a loan at, 5.7%, you go down the street and you take out a loan at 5.7%. Over time, will save a huge amount of money. It's really what HB 13 is all about. It is lowering the interest cost on our unfunded liability through the use of a financial device, a proven financial device called pension obligation bonds. Pleases the chair, I'd like to conclude my opening remarks here. The Department of Revenue, who is with me, has a detailed presentation on exactly what pension obligation bonds are and how they could be a substantial benefit to the Treasury of the state. And if it pleases the chair, I would also point, we'd be happy to discuss the details of the bill, but I would suggest that perhaps an overview presentation might be most in order at this time.
Did we not have a version of this in the previous legislature?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did. The difference between this bill and the version, in fact, the previous legislature, the 24th Alaska legislature, passed a bill out of our body that ended up, as all good bills do, it ended up, lost in Senate finance at the end of session last year. But I think it was appropriate. It was appropriate for that bill to stop there. In the previous session, this concept, the pension obligation bond concept, had been brought up, discussed. Legislators began to think about it, understand what it is, internalize it. As we come back this legislative session, we have, we're blessed with an administration that has a very contemporary view on public finance and have embraced this idea as part of their own budgeting process. I think it's a real shining star in the administration, how they're approaching Treasury and structured debt management for the state of Alaska.
Did we lose any money by not passing the bill out last year?
It could be argued, sir, that if we were able to execute one of these transactions, we lost 3% on what potentially could be whatever the amount of the bond in, the bonding transaction might have been. So in a hypothetical where we would have bonded $2 or $3 billion, which would have not been an unreasonable number, we've lost 3% of that amount and wasting a year's time.
And that would be, and you're the mathematician, how much would that be in
$30 million?
$6.00 and $0.10.
Go figure it. Yeah, exactly. Run your numbers there. What's 3% of $1 billion is 100 or 300 million?
Not bad. It's not chump change.
600 million.
30.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Brian Andrews, who is the DEPCOM in the Treasury Division, I would certainly ask him and his people to
stay up here if you like, or please come on up.
Would you like both chairs, or would you like
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Honorable members, for the record, my name is Brian Andrews, and I'm Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Revenue. Let me bring up Jay this morning, and she's going to help me with the PowerPoint here, because I'm one of these people that grew up in the age of the HP.
We don't use overhead projectors anymore. By the way, my trusty citizen lab said that was 30 million, not 300 million.
I'm just doing the commas, and he's correct.
Yeah, but it's still more than I made today. Go ahead.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This morning, I'm going to talk generally about pension obligation bonds, or the acronym POBs. I'll start with a quick description, then I'll mention some reasons why we should consider issuing pension obligation bonds, what the risks are associated with those pension bonds, and I'll touch real briefly on the various types of POBs that are out there. Then we'll get to my favorite subject, and that's the potential savings that can be associated with pension obligation bonds. And finally, I'll talk about some of the tax considerations that are associated with pension obligation bonds. The issuance of POBs is an investment strategy that tries to achieve a positive earnings arbitrage between the cost of the bonds and the earnings on the proceeds of those bonds. Let me say that simply. The goal of POBs is to reduce the cost of the pension plan's outstanding liability. A simple analogy would be paying off your credit card debt with a cheaper line of credit against your house. It's interesting to note that according to the Thomson Financial, over the past decade, there have been 340 POBs issued by the state and local governments in 26 different states. You should also note that POBs are not new to the state of Alaska. They were actually issued in 1980 by the city of Anchorage. And by the way, it was a successful issuance. Why should we consider POBs? Well, there are three primary reasons. The first is an interest rate savings on the reduction in cost. Two, the possibility of a positive earnings arbitrage. And finally, POBs are generally viewed as not adding to the debt burden of the state. We already have the debt. We're just simply replacing it with a lower cost of debt.
Just like refinancing my house.
Exactly. Exactly. And let me give you a visual here, and I'll digress for just a minute, and I'll talk about what this bill is on the unfunded liability to the pension systems. And basically, the pension system is giving to the state, and when I mention state, I'm also including local governments, a bill which, in the reevaluation of 2006, totals $8.6 billion. Of that bill, $5.5 billion is the responsibility of PERS, the Public Employees Retirement System. The $3.1 billion belongs to the Teachers Retirement System. Now, that was as of a reevaluation in 2006. We haven't seen the evaluation in 2007. And that's where everybody's coming up that this bill is actually going to be greater. So, how do we pay off that bill of $8.6 billion? There are two ways. The state can simply pay it off with cash. Or what the pension plan says is to the state is your credit is good, we'll give you a loan to pay off that bill over a 25-year period of time at a cost of 8.25%. So when we talk about interest rate savings, let me give you a simple example. The difference between 8.25% and 5.75% is 2.5%. On $1 billion, we take a look at the principal and interest payment at 8.25%, and we will see that annual payment is $96 million a year, which is the figure right there. If we can lower the cost down to 5.75%, we'll save 2.5%. Or an annual savings of $19 million a year. Now, we take that $19 million, we times it times 25, and then we discount it back at 5% to bring it into today's dollars, and that's a savings of $272 million to the system. We are in a very favorable interest rate environment today to doing pension obligation bonds. Last week, the yield on the 10-year Treasury was approximately 4.5%. We can issue POBs in the market with a premium of about 100 basis points or 1%. So last week, the cost of issuing POBs would have been between 5.6%, 5.7%. But more importantly, you can see that today's interest rate are at a very low level. In fact, they haven't been this low since the mid to late 60s. The second reason for considering the issuance of POVs is for a positive earnings arbitrage. And what am I talking about there? Just simply the difference between what we can achieve as an investment return on the proceeds of the bond issuance. But what I'd like to do is share with you what the returns have been for the PERS plan over the past 15 years. And you can see, and this is a fiscal year return, that on average for the past 15 years, we've been able to achieve a return of 9.09%. And that's also taking into effect the bear market of 2000, which was the worst bear market since the 1929 depression. So we've done a good job. Standard deviation is a measurement of volatility, and that came in at 7.25%. But what that's really saying is that two-thirds of the time, we can expect a return of somewhere between 16.3% down to a positive number of 1.8%. Here are the results for TERS, and you'll see that they vary slightly from PERS at 9.14%. The reason for the difference is timing of funds, but the portfolios are identical. And with that, I'm going to let Gary Bader, the Chief Investment Officer, come up and talk a little bit about this slide. But before I let him do that, let me also note that for the calendar year 06, the pension plans exceeded a return of north of 15%. A very good number. We trailed the CalPERS by just 10 or 20 basis points, but we had a very excellent result last year. So with that, Gary, why don't you talk a little bit about this slide.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Would you please identify yourself for...
Yes, my name is Gary Bader. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of the Department of Revenue. And just briefly about this chart, the way the pension funds attempt to maximize earnings with lowering risk is to get an assortment of different investments that will maximize that opportunity. The list that you see before you is a list of the different type investments that the pension fund invests in. Each year, Callan and Associates, the consultant for the pension fund and for the permanent fund, provides us with certain earnings assumptions and their estimate of what the volatility of those earnings will be and how well they correlate with the earnings of different asset classes. In the example you see before you, which is the current asset allocation or target asset allocation of the pension funds, the PERS and TERS for this year, they have anticipating a median return of 8.05% and then plus or minus 12.27%. As Mr. Andrews explained, that's two-thirds of the time. You might expect the range of earnings to be as high as 20% or could be as low as a negative 4%. Can have negative earnings, and we don't intend to suggest that that isn't a possibility. However, the history of the pension funds has been that they have earned north of 9%, and that's the basis upon which we suggest going forward. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. The third reason we want to consider the issuance of POVs is a credit neutrality consideration to the POVs. And we're not adding to the debt of the state. We're simply replacing the debt that's already existing with a lower cost of debt. Two quotes, one from Moody's, and I'll read them. Moody's believes the issuance of POVs is an effective way of addressing the unfunded liability. Standard & Poor's has viewed POVs as a strategy for savings on carrying charges as long as the transactions are structured and conservatively and the assumptions are reasonable and attainable. So let's move on to risk. What are the risks associated with the issuance of POBs? And I thought maybe one of the best examples is to show you what would have happened historically. Mr. Chairman, you asked Representative Hocker what the delay cost us, so let me go ahead and show you. If you see in this column here, the left column, that was the rate of return that I just showed you on the pension plans. This would have been the cost that year if we had done pension obligation bonds. And this column represents the cumulative results of issuing that bond in that particular year. For example, in 1992, we would have been able to issue the bond for 7.76%. And over the past 15 years, we would have actually had a positive cumulative result for issuing that bond of 23%. Last year, to respond to your question, if we'd issued the bonds, we probably would have issued them at about 5.55%, having a positive result just in the 1 year of 6.14%. Now, does this happen every time? No. You'll see that in 1999, if we'd issued bonds at 6.4%, there had actually been a cumulative negative result of 2%. But let me also note that if we had issued the bonds today at if we'd issued the bonds then at today's rate of 5.75%, there actually would have been a positive result, and that positive result was 3.17%. So timing is very important when you go to issue these bonds. So out of the past 15 years, 12 years were positive, and we still have another 10 years because remember the length on these bonds is for 25 years.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
It would be interesting to see that earnings structure with regard to the earnings of the permanent fund in concert, because I think there was a couple years where we feared that, I think it was around the 2001 year that we thought we may end up having not enough cash for the dividend. So I think it followed that same line.
We could certainly put the permanent fund's results alongside that if you so choose.
That'd be interesting.
Okay.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a little while ago that approximately 26 states have issued POB bonds. I would like to know whether in any jurisdiction, state or local, that has issued pension obligation bonds, what have the problems been? I'd really like to have a list of all the problems that have occurred in any jurisdiction at any time, and what those risks are and how they could be met.
Through the chair.
Synopsize those or get that to us in writing?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg will certainly provide that for you.
Is there, I note you have three pages under risks in the handout.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't, I don't think, gotten to the third one, the investment return forecast. Is that a risk page as well?
No, the next risk page that we're going to talk about is to look at a statistical tool called Monte Carlo simulation to give you a confidence level of what it would take to achieve a return greater than 5.7%.
Okay, continue.
Okay. The next page shows the results that comes out of a statistical tool called a Monte Carlo simulation. And what we do in this process, very simply, is we go back and we look at the returns on the S&P 500 for the past 25 years. We also look at the returns off the government credit bond index for the past 25 years. And we scramble those results up, okay? We actually scramble those results up over 10,000 different reiterations. And out of that, we get an idea of what the confidence level is of achieving the cost of the bonds, which in today's environment is 5.75%. So when we looked at all the various combinations over the past 25 years of returns based on a 70-30 portfolio, you can see that we were able to achieve that cost of debt 91.45% of the time.
and that the average annual return of all the samples in the Monte Carlo, we came up with 9%, very similar to the investment result that's coming from the pension plans now. Another tool. But again, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg will certainly give you a list of some of the problems that other entities have encountered with the issuance of POBs.
May I follow up?
One more.
With the other roughly 8.5%, and this sounds like a good plan, don't get me wrong, but I want the public to know that we have fully considered both sides of the issue, and we've been very conservative in determining this and other questions that are coming before the legislature. Looking at the other 8.5%, have any of that says the probability of not outperforming, but in some of those 8.5%, have there been drastically bad results?
Well, you can see what the results have been, but typically the results on average below 5.7 have been in the neighborhood of 4%.
Is there any way we can, any way we can have some insurance or anything to cut down that risk?
Through the chair, we can certainly talk about that and show some financial techniques to managing the portfolio to limiting that downside risk.
I would like to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. Let's talk about various types of POBs. And bond issuance basically fall into three different categories. General obligation bonds, which carry the full creditworthiness of the state. Bonds that are issued by obligations imposed onto the state. And then finally, annual appropriation bonds. And this is the category that pension obligations fall into. In other words, every year, the state and local governments have to budget and have an appropriation for the debt service of those bonds so that they do not carry the backing, the full credit backing of the state. But basically, every year, there has to be an appropriation to make that debt service. These are all the different flavors of POBs that are out there. They all serve different purposes in trying to achieve a financial result. It's really not my intent this morning to go into any depth on any one of these particular strategies or bond types, but just simply to present them to you this morning and then let you evaluate the advantages and disadvantages on your own. Again, a very quick comparison table between the pluses and minuses of POBs. Now, let's talk about my favorite subject, which is the potential savings that can be achieved through proceeds from pension obligation bonds and by using cash to pay down that unfunded debt. And you'll see that by doing that, we have an immediate reduction in the unfunded liability. We increase the funding ratio with the pension plans, and we can see a reduction in the employer's contribution rate. Here's some matrix for you. And in these matrix, you'll see that on the vertical column is a cash balance, and over the top is the proceeds that would come from a pension obligation bond. And in these matrix, we'll go from the top left down and then over to the right column and then down. And you'll see that right now today, the contribution rate in the PERS program is 44%. That's if we do nothing. That's the contribution rate that the state and local governments is faced with. Now remember, in the PERS system, this is an average rate, and I'm looking at it in total, and I'm not looking at any one individual participant's rate, but that's the average rate. And you'll see that if we come up with cash of $500 million or $1.5 billion here, we can start paying down that unfunded liability rate, and we can start paying it down towards what's called the normal contribution rate level. Okay? But what happens is if we just do pension obligation bonds, and you'll see that if we do $1.5 billion, which represents 27% of that unfunded liability, we can reduce the contribution rate from 44% down to 42%. Doesn't sound like much. In fact, it's only a savings of 1.73%. But remember, we're talking about percentages on big dollars. And when we do that, you can see that the average savings is $28 million a year to the pension system. And over 25 years, that represents a savings of $408 million at a discounted rate of 5%. Let me show you an example where we use both cash and pension obligation bonds. And you'll see in TERS, today's contribution rate is 57%. If we put in $500 million, and $2 billion of proceeds from the pension obligation bonds, we can see that that rate will go down to 43%. A savings of 14% to the contribution rate for employers, that's an annual savings of $86 million a year. Over the life of this debt, that's a savings of $1.2 billion. Let me briefly touch upon tax issues. The reason that POBs are taxable bonds is that the IRS takes a very dim view of using tax-exempt privilege that is given to states and local entities for capital projects. And they take a very dim view of using that tax-exempt privilege for an earnings arbitrage play. And that, very simply, is why we look at issuing taxable bonds for pension obligations. Now, having said that, the Department of Revenue is currently evaluating various tax-exempt strategies that we might have to use, or we could use. But at this point, those strategies, I'd just like to point out, is that they have to be coincidental to the infusion of those proceeds back into the PERS and TERS programs. There cannot be a direct link. Otherwise, we will run afoul of the Internal Revenue Service. And we don't particularly want an audit at this time. So what are the takeaways? POB issuance is a financial transaction which will lower the cost of funding and unfunded liability for the state and local governments. We are in a very favorable interest rate environment. Let's take advantage of it. The risks associated with POB issuances are quantifiable and statistically justified by the rewards, and doing nothing is not a viable option. Albert Einstein said, "The most powerful force in the universe is compounded interest." And if we don't address this unfunded liability, it will continue to grow at a compounded rate of 8.25%. It won't grow linear, it will grow exponentially, and then it will go parabolic. So the time is to take care of it now. Just so that we're all clear on this, the Department of Revenue's position on POBs is that over the long run, we believe that the POB program is a prudent, program that is prudently implemented has a high probability of success. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you for a very lucid explanation of what could be a rather complicated process, but I think putting it into the context of, you know, at various times I've refinanced my home loan, and so far with very good results on that. So that is, in plain layman's language, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Just refinancing the debt at a lower interest rate with commensurate savings. Did I oversimplify it?
To the chair, very good job. Sure. Thank you.
I may have your job there. Who knows? Representative Gernberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What role are POBs playing in the governor's overall strategy to deal with the unfunded PERS and TERS liability?
If I may, I would think there used to be one tool among many that can be done. There are other legislative authors to address the very same issue. But I would think it would be, you know, a combination of things.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that is correct. It's just one tool of many to look at budgetary savings in the budget.
Give very, very briefly, what are the others?
Well, again, if through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, if there's cash, we would like to use that to pay down the unfunded.
If there's what?
If there's cash available, there that's an option that's available to pay down this unfunded liability.
That it? For now?
Yeah, anything else? That's so those are the only two?
Well, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the other solution is we can continue to pay these high contribution rates. One of the alternative solutions is to do nothing and just continue to pay at these exorbitant contribution levels.
I believe there's another bill on the horizon that from Representative Kelly that addresses some of these issues, to changing the contribution rates and so on. Representative Coghill.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they've talked about, even in the governor's bill is somehow a blending of a rate so that we would share the burden between the states and the municipalities. One of the things, going back to page 10 of your presentation, credit rating considerations, Standard & Poor's is quoted here, and reasonable and attainable. Is there an industry standard that we need to know about that, excuse me, that they would say reasonable and attainable? I think what you showed us would seem reasonable to me, but I wonder what their standard is.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. Typically, a rating agency would look for a funding level no more than 80% of the unfunded liability. If you start exceeding that 80% level, then what happens potentially is in the future you might go to an overfunded scenario, and that overfunded scenario would then be used for additional benefits to the pension plan, which would not then call for the payment of the debt down. So there gets to be a situation where you can overdo the proceeds from a bond issuance. So succinctly, Representative Coghill, it's about an 80% funding level is what's considered prudent.
Okay. Governor Coghill?
So then, Mr. Chairman, on page 18, where you talk about case studies 18 and 19, you picked the very conservative numbers, it looks like. Page 19, he picked the $500 million mark. What do you anticipate that would be, excuse me, I just got something in my throat. What do you anticipate would be the bonding level that we would go at? It seemed to me it would be over $500 million.
On page 18, the example that I showed in suggesting is a combination of $500 million of cash and $2 billion worth of pension obligation bonds, which actually brings that funding level up to about a 92% level.
Representative Dahl.
How much money did you say we already we have in the pension fund right now?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, which pension fund?
Inside the employee pension fund, what do we have accumulated at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, in total, both plans have assets of about $15 billion.
$15
billion. Any questions at this point?
And so, Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
just to be clear, that $15 billion represents somewhere just north of 60%, I think, of the actual expected value of the payout. Is that true?
Representative, through the chair, Representative Coghill, yes, that's correct. The funding ratios of the pension plans versus their unfunded liability is about 60-65%.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, the obligation bonds are going to be helping us manage that 30% or 27% or 25% unfunded liability. So, and my expectation then, Mr. Chairman, would be I wonder how far we have to go. Do we have to go beyond the 90%, or is it reasonable to say that even 85% funding of the obligation is reasonable? And I suppose that's a discussion for somewhat in this arena, because we're trying to figure out what portion of this is going to fit.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, again, what is viewed as a reasonable funding level out there is an 80% funding ratio.
80, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Any other questions? No, I want to thank you again very much for a very clear, lucid explanation. But we do have one more question.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. First of all, I appreciate you bringing pictures.
we like.
It is. This is not a simple issue. So I appreciate it. On the cities or our local municipalities will also be able to issue these bonds. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. That's kind of a moving target from the standpoint that the administration has also submitted a level pay bill. If that level pay bill goes through for the public employees retirement system, there's going to be some sort of ratio. They're taking the PERS program and making it look like TERS. What that funding ratio will be, you know, 70-30, 65-15, whatever comes out in the end, is the ratio that would be shared as a cost on the pension obligation bonds.
Very good. Representative Johnson?
So the state will be the only ones actually issuing the bonds. The cities will just share in the returns. Is that correct? The cities won't actually be able to, say, go and pick their portfolios. My question is, do they have the expertise to do it if, in fact, they're going to be involved in that kind of decision-making?
Through the chair, the simple answer, Representative Johnson, is the state will be issuing the bonds.
Very good. Oh, and for the record, I should have mentioned it when you first started. Representative Roses has an excused absence today. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have several people who I have on my list here on off-net. So I'm going to say for answer question only, listen only, but I'm going to go down the list here to see if any these people would like to make comments at this point. From Goldman Sachs, Frank Ingracia. Are you there, sir?
Thank you very much. I don't think there's anything to add to Mr. Andrews' comments. I thought he was very precise and very clear.
Very good. And your colleagues there, Goldman Sachs, Mr. Schober and Ms. Karnick and Andy Pinzel, do they have anything to add?
No, I don't believe so.
Thank you for being with us. We have Isaac Sine and Jeff Brown from Merrill Lynch. Do you have any comments you'd like to share with us?
We would concur. This is Greg Sundberg with Merrill Lynch. We concur with Mr. Ingracia's statement that Mr. Andrews did a very fine job of explaining a complex topic. The only thing we'd like to underscore is that pension bonds are but one tool in addressing the unfunded liability, and we think that the state's approach to this to date has been extremely responsible.
Thank you. Then we have Lindsay Softy and Carol Samuel from Seattle Northwest.
Yes, we're here. And again, we agree with everything Mr. Andrews said, and I think he did a great job.
Well, there's a mutual admiration society we've got going on here.
Which one was
that, please? Yeah. Who was that? Was that Carol Samuel? Was that you?
Oh, sorry. No, that's Lindsay Softy.
Thank you. Thank you, Lindsay, so much. Yeah. Is anybody in the audience who would like to add anything to what's been said? If not, I'll close public testimony on HB 13 and open up for discussion in the committee. Any comments, discussion in the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dahl.
I'm just trying to get a sense of the risk in this and the... the problems with medical and just what the future looks like with increasing medical costs. And so I'm trying to weigh this in, if someone could sort of address that in terms of what it might look like in another 5 or 6 years from now with the increasing medical costs that go along with the funding. That would be helpful.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you through the chair. The issue of resolving our unfunded pension liability exists because we have less financial resources, less money in the pension trusts than what we estimate the liabilities to be today. Where today we are estimating, and as Mr. Andrews pointed out, the most recent valuation was the $8.6 billion shortfall. Most of us are anticipating the new calculation to be in excess of $10 billion. As your question goes to what would an even a greater escalation in medical costs be to the future, it would actually widen that gap. And in these transactions as contemplated here, would further emphasize the need for us to, with that larger unfunded liability, clearly accumulating an even greater rate of interest, it makes it even, to me, more paramount that we take advantage of the ability to mitigate some of that interest cost, in that the risk of future medical growth is not part of the market risk associated with a transaction like this at all.
It's your choice, whatever you want.
No? Okay. Any other questions for Representative Mr. Representative Coghill?
Just a question about cities. I missed what you said about the city's ability to issue bonds, and maybe you could explain that again. Also, my impression is that some of the municipalities are caught up and have paid into this into their pension funds and are not owing. Now, maybe you can clarify this for me, but my understanding is that all these things have been put into a big pot. All the cities, there's a sort of a general owing category, but in fact, some of the cities have actually paid up and maybe even done some more into the future. Could you sort of speak as to the city's liabilities in this, the municipality's liabilities in this, and whether they would all be expected to participate in the issuance of these bonds?
Through the chair,
Reverend Hogger.
Representative Lynn, sir. The questions you're raising here, quite frankly, go very much to many of the issues brought that are in other bills before us. As Representative Groombert asked, what bills are out there with the current PERS system, which has it's a single plan where the different cities participate. The state itself has a very large piece of the obligation there. What we'd be largely looking at here would be the bill empowers governmental employers across the state to utilize and structure transactions that may be specifically beneficial to their interests, as they have each one of these entities has a different interest in that PERS liability right now. The other bill that is moving through the legislature at the moment, at least the House bill side of it, 206, would be the bill that would create a level.
Excuse me, that's Representative Kelly's bill?
No, sir, that would be the administration's bill.
Okay.
It actually parallels many of the provisions of Representative Kelly's bill. Would be to more, there is at issue today between the municipalities and the state who owns what portion of that liability. That bill is there to address and resolve that issue. Mr. Andrews would certainly invite Mr. Chairman his counsel on any of these questions as well.
Thank you. Reverend Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had told the chair that I would certainly support the movement of this bill at the earliest opportunity, and I intend to keep my word on that. But I would like, given that is the chair's wish, if Mr. Andrews could answer my question a little bit now, some of the risks, so that we get that on the record and discuss that if we're going to move the bill today.
If I might, excuse me, Mr.
Or, Chairman, or Representative Hawkins.
Preliminary response before handing it to Mr. Andrews here. I believe the bill package included a primer, an educational document on pension bonds by the ORIC organization. That primer itself has some excellent risk analysis and specific case histories that you might find interesting in discussing where entities have frankly inadvisedly entered into transactions. I point to perhaps Mr. Andrews, in that he is with the Department of Revenue, would be the most credible voice here in discussing what are the known risks of, circumstances in which you could make an unadvised decision, and how we certainly have put controls on over our process to avoid making any unadvised decisions.
Yes, sir.
To the chair, through the chair, Representative Groombert, when you evaluate pension obligations, the two factors that seem to have a high correlation with an unsuccessful issuance is, one, the timing into the market. And what I mean by that is the interest rate cost that is paid on the pension obligation bonds. Typically, the entities that issued bonds in the late 90s, early 2000s, issued those bonds at a high interest rate. And that a high interest rate has worked against them, as I tried to point out. That's probably the number one factor. You'll see that in House Bill 13, there's language that basically controls that by saying that there has to be a positive earnings arbitrage, excuse me, interest rate arbitrage of 1.5% before we can issue the bonds. The second major factor.
It would help me, although I must say, having been on Ways and Means, I should be more up than I am. Is there a particular section you'd like to refer the committee to on that point so we can, in the bill?
Through the chair, I'm where the 1.5% is within the bill?
Yeah. Let's see here. I'd like the record to be very clear that we have specifically dealt with these and we have considered them, and I'd like the record to reflect where in the bill this problem is dealt with.
That should be in Section 8, I believe. Should be in the Pension Bond Corporation statute, shouldn't it be? Mm-hmm.
Section 8 is on page 10.
11 and 12.
Page 12?
11 and 12 also.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That would be on page 14, line 29, proposed statutory code section 37.16.080, where we discuss purposes and sufficiency of revenue. And this is in the authority creating an Alaska Municipal Bond Corporation for the purpose of conducting a state transaction or facilitating a state transaction. And actually, and my ever-efficient aide points out that throughout this bill, wherever there is an authority for any state agency or public agency to conduct transactions, the 1.5% is repeated throughout the bill.
Thank you. Please continue.
Through the chair.
No, he's still.
I beg your pardon.
No problem. Through the chair, Representative Groomer, the second factor that has weighed against the issuance of POBs is when an issuing entity has taken those proceeds from the bond sale and not used those to lower the unfunded liability, but used those to fix other budgetary purposes or problems that they're having.
Through the chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Is that prohibited in the bill?
Hey, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I do not know that we have a specific prohibition there, but the authority is specifically for the purpose of addressing unfunded pension liabilities.
Through the chair.
Representative Grunberg.
To be absolutely sure, should we add a provision that does that?
Representative
Grunberg, I would defer that question to members of the State Department of Law. As that is a legal decision, legal question. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not qualified to practice law in the state of Alaska.
Through the chair. I see Mike Barnhill in the background trying to slink away. I would ask if Mr. Barnhill is the relevant person, if he could come up and answer that question.
You could ask me to ask him.
I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Mr. Chair, would you be good enough to ask him?
I would be good enough to accommodate almost everything you ask, Reverend Greenberg. Not everything, but almost everything. Please come up.
Thank you.
I don't want to.
Anything you say may be used against you. You have the right to remain silent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Department of Law, through the chair to Representative Grunberg. I believe the bill requires the proceeds of the bond issuance to be paid into the to the Commissioner of Administration and into the pension fund. So I don't believe any additional language is required to assure that. And the fact of the matter is, bond counsel will require that in the bond documents, that the money be used for that purpose. So I don't think there's any conceivable way the money could be diverted to some other purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Mr. Andrews could come back through the chair and continue his answer. Are there any other, through the chair, are there any other risks, sir? Thank you, Mr. Barnhill.
There are always risks, and just coming to work today is a risk.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, those are the two primary factors that create an unfavorable bond issuance.
The reason I'm asking, Mr. Chair, is because I know bond counsel attorneys as a subcategory are among the most careful and cautious members of the legal profession, and so far more than us family lawyers. And that's why I'm asking, just to be absolutely sure here we're not getting ourselves in any trouble. Is there any other possible risk that you'd like to put on the record and how we're addressing it? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. There is no guarantee with these. I mean, nobody's going to guarantee us a positive earnings arbitrage. But let me state, you know, record has proven out that over the long haul, the cost of the POBs are typically covered by the investment results.
And I know through the chair that Representative Hawker is a very cautious person and thorough, and I rely a lot on him. My staff, if I may, and Mr. Cohen, please correct me through the chair if I'm not asking this correctly, suggests a discussion on Section 1 of the bill. Please explain Section 1 and the ability of school districts to prepay and lower arbitration rates. Section 1 of the bill.
And through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think you meant to say arbitrage rates, not arbitration rates.
Did I say No. Contribution rates. His handwriting is not as good as mine. Now, is it a single? Is it a single system? Does this change the TRS system? How does this affect school districts differently? Small versus large, rich versus poor.
Through the chair,
Representative Hawker.
Representative Grunberg, the this time I wanted to address this issue before we moved further today, as it was the issue that, as this bill left the committee I chair, which is Ways and Means Committee. Representative Seaton had raised it at the latter moments of moving the bill. We promised Rep. Seaton that we would address that specifically on the record in this committee, which the short answer is that no, as contemplated in the bill, it would not affect the single rate structure of the TERS system. But we have both folks online and Mr. Andrews here who could address that more specifically with you.
Through the chair, could Mr. Andrews please do that?
Please.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I just support what Representative Hawker said there, that what we're trying to do, or what Representative Hawker is trying to do in HB 13, is provide a lot of optionality out there. And because the TERS is a single-pay system, typically this is a call on the state's general fund. So. Through that mechanisms, all the teachers' retirement systems will be participating in this indebtedness in an equal fashion.
Thank you for your
any further questions, Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, one of the pains that I've had since I've been in the legislature is creating another government corporation. So it always pains me to create another government corporation. Always pains me. But this is very singularly focused, so so I probably won't complain too much about that because it is highly focused. However, what was the discussion that got to the board of directors issue? I see we have it's going to be just in section 8, the board of directors section on page 10, you have commissioner of Commerce, Community Economic Development, and Revenue. Is that...
They're in the same directors as the bond committee.
I guess the question I have is there a need to transcend a particular administration? And do we need to put something in here that gives us that kind of continuity between administrations? Just a thought, if it went into this this bill.
Through the chair,
Representative Hawker.
Representative Coghill. Just for a reference point, where the state currently has a bond committee for all managing state indebtedness as it exists currently, consists of the same board of directors as being assigned here. So that continuity issue, as you bring forth, essentially already exists within the state. I think the real cohesiveness that transcends the temporal nature of any individual administration, and even positions vary, even while an individual administration is in office, what transcends this is that we're dealing with very contractual obligations that are, these bond indentures are very specific legal documents, very carefully scripted, as I think this to say, Wall Street is an extraordinarily conservative place to go, conduct business. And so the combination of the bond indenture agreements themselves that any debt issuance entails, and the continuity of bond counsel, the continuing legal counsel, really in our case, I believe, compensates for the inherently temporal nature of folks that serve at the will of the people of the state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate that answer. I think I knew that, but I needed to hear it for some comfort. And then the other thing is, what would be the expectation in a practical manner of changing the indebtedness structure? For example, should we get into a windfall situation and we wanted to either increase the indebtedness, or let's just say we had a market change that was significant, what would be the temptation or the test of should we increase the bonded indebtedness under this scenario? I'm just trying to think of what would be, first of all, additional, and then the second question is, what would be the expectation of cash from the legislature on down the road? Is there, we would certainly be, if there, whatever the arbitrage number is, we have to appropriate, I think, is one way that we'll be involved. What other ways would we be involved? I'm thinking of the practical terms.
Good question.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. Other than, I'd like to, prefacing comment that I'd bring, again, I think that's a best directed to the Treasury Management of the Department of Revenue today. But as you say, what's our responsibility downstream? Today, our responsibility is to come up with $10 billion to pay off this liability. and that is, it's a constitutional obligation we have. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to be making light of that comment. We absolutely have an obligation to come find a way to solve this liability. And what we're trying to, again, with this bill, we're filling a toolbox with tools. And this is not at all, by any means, a silver bullet. It is but one tool in our arsenal to deal with this problem. Sort of perhaps the specifics of how the department might address changing fiscal situations into the future, I would ask that Mr. Andrews contribute to our conversation.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, the only thing that I would add to Representative Hawker's comments is that in the bill, there is a cap of $5 billion of issuance of POBs. So, there is that maximum amount that has to be taken into consideration.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, just from the young, inexperienced legislative view of that, that sounds like half of the obligation would be maxed out.
Through the chair, that's correct. Representative Coghill.
And also, Mr. Chairman, if I might, through the chair, Representative Coghill, as Mr. Andrews testified to earlier, this is that concept of what is full funding in this context? What would be prudent to fully fund our obligation? They said that in this case, it would really be imprudent for us to fund 100% of that obligation because, as we know to the future, market prices will go up and down, and history has shown that while these models that are presented here are based on a presumed return of the roughly 8% investment, we have been very fortunate over time to achieve a significantly higher rate, which would be, you know, be imprudent for us to fund to 100%. We could end up overfunded. So again, those sort of you know, strictures would be in here. But as any, you know, I'm a very strong proponent throughout all legislative process of recognizing that times change, and every future legislature has to be able to, and administration has to be in position to make policies, decisions, determinations that take into consideration the facts and circumstances they find themselves in. Today, we're setting up a toolbox here, and a tool that we could take a part, and we can feel very comfortable making a contribution to a whatever degree, or to this degree. You know, we've looked here at the potentially $1.5 or $2 billion of contribution to the TERS system would be very prudent today. I don't see us going beyond that, but a future, there's nothing here that would prohibit a future administration or legislature from making additional decisions utilizing these tools or even changing direction.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cargill.
Alaska is really interesting. We can be broke one day and awash the next. And
we call it chicken or feathers.
There could be anticipated a day where we could actually, through a windfall, pay off the top 50%, still retain a bonding rate that then we put in tension what that bonding rate could be. So I guess that's a discussion I hope we get to, but I don't anticipate any time in the near future. So, but I just thought I'd ask the question for my own benefit.
No, can you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman. Representative Cockhill is absolutely correct, and were we to be the beneficiary of some phenomenal financial windfall, and in fact, I suspect that Representative Cockhill and myself might even at this moment, I'm willing to put more of today's surplus into the pension plans than many legislators are, because I think it's one of the best investments the state has. When we could be putting today's surplus into the pension plans with sort of the assurity that we're mitigating a 8.5% liability, when if we put it into the Constitutional Budget Reserve, we've been earning about 3.7%. I very strongly propose that. And there are financial mechanisms available to the state that were we to encounter into the future some phenomenal financial windfall, that we could then literally defease the cost of these obligations as well. We have plenty of opportunity to, and in fact, that's even provided for in the bill, is specifically provided for, that there's the authority for the state to defease obligations should we have that unexpected opportunity.
I hope that's a problem we are forced to deal with.
But the language did anticipate it, and that was in my reading of the bill. I got a little confused when I first read it until I kind of, the light went on. So,
fine. Is there any other discussion on this? I will, after Representative Cock, Grunberg, you may entertain a motion.
Sure, of course. Through the chair, back to the question on page 10 about the Board of Directors, lines 18 through 22, AS 37-16-020. The three directors are all commissioners and subject to removal at the pleasure of the governor. This makes the board quite vulnerable to changes not only in administration, but within the administration. Are other boards of directors of these corporations in other states set up like this so they're so sensitive to a strong executive? Is there any broader participation, any additional control by, say, the legislature or outside people being on here? The reason I'm saying this is because there is quite a difference between the last administration's view of this concept and this. And I, it's not just a question to me of whether we might have a problem in once the bonds are set up, but whether we would be maybe wisely or unwisely prevented from issuing new bonds when we should. How much independence is there? How would that affect the bond rating? How have other jurisdictions dealt with that particular issue?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. I think what is most relevant to us is the constitutional structure that we live in under this, in this state. And I think it's, you know, certainly generally construed that Alaska's constitution provides, amongst all the 50 states, for one of the strongest executive branch functions. It was, again, that was a constitutional determination made low those 50 years ago. And to that end, or as part of that determination, it is the these very important policy-making positions. The commissioners of the various state departments are, they do enjoy much much greater powers than they do in other states. So I think what's most important for us here is that we are looking to how this issue functions in Alaska and what are the appropriate mitigating controls over political volatility would be. And to that end, I repeat the response I gave to Representative Coghill earlier. The real management, the real transactional control here is the public market, the marketplace. The financial markets provide the greatest consistency and control over both a renegade commissioner who, or a renegade board of directors that wants to go and enter the marketplace in an irresponsible manner. The marketplace will control, will step in and say, no, this is just not going, you know, the market is the one taking the risk because they have to absorb the risk that we could or could not meet our obligations. So market, the market itself is the single greatest mitigating control, and that market then is comprised of both the people that would be in the markets to purchase bonds, the underwriters who would be underwriting the transactions, and the legal community who would be structuring the transactions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One moment. Anything else? If not, I'll entertain a motion on the bill.
I'll move the bill with individual
recommendations. Okay. Moved by Representative Grunberg, individual recommendations.
And there's an indeterminate fiscal note.
Indeterminate fiscal note.
And I would, Mr. Chairman, just I hate to stop moving the bill. The fiscal note is indeterminate because this bill does not authorize or empower any individual transaction. It gives the state the authority to pursue them and bring them back to us.
Thank you. When you have the votes, don't say anything.
So that we
okay. Without objection, the bill is passed. Again, I'd like to congratulate the presenters on what, at first appearance, appears to be very, very complicated, but in fact, it's not so. So, good luck in the bill. I'm glad we're trying to address the issue.
Thank you.
I'm going to take just a short at ease here before we proceed. Committee on whoops. Well, I guess I don't know where it all took off to, but I can continue. We are meeting again on Saturday at 10 o'clock. On Saturday, 10 o'clock, we anticipate hearing HB 92 with Reverend Stoltz's bill on jurisdiction of the ombudsman, and we'll maybe hearing HB 151 on indemnity clauses and public contracts, Representative Johnson, and perhaps HB 171 on accommodating the 90th session. Anything further to come before the committee? If not, the committee is adjourned, and we're setting a record here at 20 minutes.